Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, an Illinois university looks to attract more students after years of seeing enrollment fall. Also, some residents of Illinois may be getting new neighbors, Afghans who have fled their home country being resettled here in Illinois. But that brings challenges.
We may likely be receiving families that have no connection to the area, and that is a much more difficult process because they don't feel comfortable with anyone here yet.
The Chicago Bears are making a play for land in the suburbs. Could the team be on the move from the city of Chicago? And what could the team gain by making that happen? Also, while high school football players are back on the field this fall, many are still missing out on playing time due to a rule that some say needs to be changed. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, more people are entering the trades, and we'll talk with some about their career decision. While the focus has been on the COVID vaccine, other vaccinations, especially for children, have fallen off. We'll hear from some doctors raising concerns. And we'll visit a convention for those who collect vacuum cleaners. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. The NFL's Chicago Bears began playing in the city in 1921. They've been at Soldier Field along the lakefront since 1971. But for how much longer? There is plenty of speculation about the team's future. Joining us to shed some light on what's happening is Tony Arnold. He's a reporter for member station WBEZ. And Tony, let's get right to it. I can remember when the state approved a big renovation for Soldier Field about 20 years ago, changed the whole look of the facility. Is it outdated already? Is that the problem?
I don't know. The problem is that it's outdated so much as it's not going to be enough to take the Bears into the future. I think that's the team's perspective here. The stadium itself is, it doesn't seat nearly as many as many of the new NFL stadiums. We're talking anywhere from 20 to 40,000 more people could, are going to stadium football seats in other cities and not in Chicago. Cities, I should say, that are much smaller than Chicago. So if you take that as just one exhibit, that's, you know, the Bears could be selling 25% more tickets if they just had more seats. But Soldier Field can't handle that much. The facility itself needs some updating. And I think the Bears are looking to their landlord, the Chicago Park District, for some guidance about what that is. And then you add to it the fact that sports gambling is now legal in Illinois. And all the major teams want to basically get aligned to that source of revenue and that advertising money. All of these three issues have basically come up in some documents that I received from the Chicago mayor's office that came to me recently, all of which were leading up to the Bears' announcement over the summer that they put in a bid to buy some property in the suburbs.
Yeah, and I want to get into that site in just a moment. You were able, as you mentioned, to obtain some email conversations from the Chicago Park District, between the Park District and the Bears. What did you learn from what was in those documents?
There's a very tense relationship. Honestly, it was just downright nasty. A lot of accusations between the Bears president, Ted Phillips, and the head of the Chicago Park District, Michael Kelly. The Park District here owns Soldier Field. And so the Bears basically are just, think of them as the tenants. And they're lodging their complaints with their landlord. The complaints in these emails, they all come, we're looking at a span here from April and May of this year, leading up to the June announcement that the Bears put in a bid to buy this property in the suburbs. And what I found is that the Bears said, we want to build a sports book near Soldier Field. Until that's built, we want to put in a sports betting lounge inside Soldier Field so fans can see what the betting lines look like. There can be ads placed in these locations. Park District will give you 20% of the money that we get from those ads. Park District said no. The Bears had a meeting with the mayor of Chicago in April of this year. At that meeting, the Bears said, we want some reports about what this what the infrastructure needs are for Soldier Field. What's the life expectancy for the plumbing, the electricity? And the park district said, we give you those documents all the time. Well, the Bear said, no, you're not. Those documents don't meet anywhere near what the expectations that we have. They don't tell us what we need to know. And then thirdly, the Bears said, we want a five-year capital plan, a five-year infrastructure plan for Soldier Field. And the park district didn't respond in the documents that I received. There's clearly no love lost between these two. At one point, the Bears president's accusing the park district of not negotiating in good faith on creating a sports betting lounge or a sports book around Soldier Field. The park district president, superintendent, is accusing the Bears, essentially stopping short of accusing the Bears president of lying about the structural improvements at Soldier Field. And he talks about how they've been reduced to basically writing letters to each other because they won't talk to each other on the phone. It's clearly a very volatile relationship.
Well, how much of this sports book idea, how much of that is playing in, do you feel, to this whole discussion? Because I guess I look back and I can remember, I guess it was about 20 years ago, the idea of these luxury boxes. Every team suddenly had to have the luxury sky boxes. Sports betting seems to be the next frontier of making money. Is that really what's going on here, do you believe? Is it more about trying to get that for the Bears?
I think that's a piece of it, sure. I don't know that that's the motivating factor. I think the facilities are probably number one. The addition of sports betting being legal in Illinois, I think that that could be more beneficial to the casinos, frankly, than the sports teams, although there would be a cut for the teams in addition to the advertising that comes from that. So, and if you're watching any professional sports team on TV, you're seeing that ad money at work. Because you can't turn on a game on them without seeing something for DraftKings or FanDuel or here in Chicago, you know, Bet Rivers, Rivers Casino. So the ad money is certainly there. What I would say is that what you have here in this exchange that I read here from the documents I received, the Bears are accusing basically the Park District of refusing to engage in good faith discussions, which is business speak for, you know, fighting words. Them's are fighting words.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot, I know, has gone on record a few times saying the NFL won't allow the Bears to move, saying because they have a lease and the lease runs till, I believe, 2033. So kind of under the assumption that the Bears are going to have to stay put no matter what. Is there truth to that, or is there a way out?
I think if the Bears want to buy this property, build up a stadium, which would take a few years, you're looking at either going up against 2033 or probably legal action and getting a judge to decide, can they break the lease or not? You know, from what I've read, the Bears, if they do break that lease, it wouldn't really cost them that much money. And so I don't know if that's enough to keep the Bears from going forward with this plan, should they choose to do it, should they even win the bid for the property in the first place. They still have to win the bid first. And then decide, you know, are they serious here, or can Chicago give them something that would entice them enough to want to stay along the lakefront at their current property?
Now, for people that aren't familiar as much with the Chicago region, we're talking about property that they put a bid in on. This is the property that was the Arlington Racecourse, appears to be headed for demolition. Is it attractive enough for the Bears to move there? Is it, you know, too far away from the city? You know, people might wonder that.
I certainly wonder that. Sure. It's in the northwest suburbs, a lot closer to O'Hare than downtown Chicago. But if you're in the south suburbs, southwest suburbs, it's going to be harder to get to a game. You have basically one suburban train line to get out there if you're not driving. But on the plus side, the Bears would be getting more than 300 acres of property to build an arena that they could potentially, in theory, own themselves. They don't have to get permission to do whatever they want to do there from a landlord. They could make the arena much bigger, more modern, needs have changed since Soldier Field was renovated 20 years ago. You could add a sports book there. And I think you would get the mayor of Arlington Heights, the village board there where the track is currently, to be much more, I would say, amenable to what the Bears want to do. In the city, you have a lot of regulations. You're constricted by what you can do around there.
Most fans are probably watching the team on the field this time of the year, not always thinking about some of this behind-the-scenes maneuvering, but is there a timeline coming up, something that we need to be watching for with this issue, and will it happen anytime soon?
Right now, the Cards are in the hands of Churchill Downs Incorporated. It's the company that's based out of Kentucky. It owns Arlington Racetrack, and so they can pick the winning bid, and there are other bids. We don't have a timeline or a sense of when they're going to decide or announce who the winning bid is for their property, let alone what that winner wants to do with it.
That's Tony Arnold, a reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. You can read the latest about the Chicago Bears and his reporting about a potential move from Soldier Field. We have a link at our website, Statewide Show. That's at nprillinois.org. And Tony, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
High school sports are back, but things aren't necessarily working out for everyone. A lot of schools have had to cancel contests because of COVID-19 exposures, and that creates an interesting situation, especially for high school football. Ryan Mahan is a sports writer for the State Journal Register in Springfield, and he wrote about this and joins me now. Ryan, a team gets a win when their opponent forfeits. So I guess what is the problem with that?
It should just be, you know, a win and a loss, and then the team who can still play should be able to freely go out, schedule another game so those kids get to be on the field that Friday night and they don't have to sit around and waste another Friday where they're not playing like they did last year. But instead, there's no incentives by the Illinois High School Association, the governing body for high school sports. Out of four teams, if two take forfeit losses and they can't play, you would think the natural fit would be for the other two teams to schedule a game against each other. Hey, let's just get out there on the field. Let's just play. But if one of those teams loses, you're charged with a loss. But if you don't play, if you just take your forfeit win and go home, your kids have lost the opportunity to play. And it's only a 9-game regular season. You know, a year ago, the whole movement was let us play. We're back. We're playing. We've got games. But unfortunately, the IHSA has actually incentivized teams not to play and take your forfeit win because, as we all know, it takes 5 wins to qualify for the postseason in high school football.
This is an issue, right, that is unique to football when it comes, because other sports are having these problems too, but it has to do more with, at the end of the season, what your record is and being able to, whether or not you're going to be able to get to the playoffs.
Yeah, volleyball, soccer, boys basketball, girls basketball, every sport out there outside of football, every team qualifies for the postseason. So if you play 10 games and lose all 10, and there's another person that plays 30 games and wins all 30, you're both in the postseason. Now, the 0-10 team is going to get the worst seed. But in football, if you're not one of the top 256 teams in the state record-wise, you don't get in. If you're a bubble team, if they're looking at it and they say, boy, you know, like I could go schedule that big bad school from Chicago, but we're going to lose that game. And then that's going to jeopardize us making the playoffs. They'll take the forfeit win. When all the IHSA has to do, the governing body, all the IHSA needs to do with this, tell teams, if you're the beneficiary of the forfeit, you get the win and you can go schedule whoever you want. And it's not going to count in your win-loss record. The most important thing is to give those kids the opportunity to go out there and play a game. They played 6 games in the spring. They didn't have a fall season. Anyone who was a junior last school year got shortened by 3 games. And if your coach decides not to play this week, you're shortened a game this week. And you're working hard. You're doing all the off-season stuff. You're doing the weightlifting. You're doing off-season camps. You're doing 7-on-7s. All athletes work their craft really hard. But those kids, as we know, I mean, they're out doing some pretty hard stuff in sometimes 100-degree heat indexes. For them to lose a game here or there because, you know, their team doesn't want to lose, just doesn't fit right with me.
Now, some teams, though, have gone ahead and scheduled games. So this has been happening. I believe one of the teams right here in Central Illinois, Rochester, a powerhouse in football, went way out of their classification to play a team from Northern Illinois. They at least gave their kids an opportunity.
Yeah, Derek Leonard will tell you, I wasn't worried about missing the playoffs. When Derek Leonard can schedule a Loyola Academy, which is an 8A school, it's enrollment-wise, classification-wise, it's one of the biggest 32 teams in the playoffs every year. And they're a really good program. And when Rochester took the field and you saw down the field and you saw the Loyola kids, I mean, they were huge. Rochester lost 56-7. Rochester did it because you play the toughest competition to find out really where your weaknesses are, where you could improve.
This comes down to IHSA policy, and they, at this point, the IHSA does not want to change that policy. Is that correct?
Correct. They had the opportunity to address this in the before the season began, and they said, nope, we're going to leave the exhibition rule the same. Executive Director Craig Anderson told me, it's our belief that if two teams play a game, that's a contest. That should count. And it's a noble belief, but this is a totally a different year. This is not a normal situation. Board of Directors looked at it again earlier this month and said, nope, we like our policy.
You quoted one coach, a McChesney Park Harlem coach, Bob Moynihan, and he talked about that even the kids don't like this system.
No, and he mentioned that your kids know, you know, if your team chooses not to play week five because you're trying to get in the playoffs, you know, he alluded to your kids don't respect that. Your kids know that you don't have the confidence in your kids. And I think the kids just want to get out there and play. I think if you ask any kid across the state of Illinois, hey, would you rather take a forfeit win or would you rather get out there on the field and play? By and large, those kids will tell you, we want to be out on the field. Win or lose, we'd rather put it out there on the line.
That's Ryan Mahan. He's a sports writer for the State Journal Register in Springfield, and you can read his story. We have a link at our website at nprillinois.org, taking a look at the system when it comes to forfeitures in high school football in Illinois. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
There is more to come on Statewide. As many Afghans flee their country and come to the U.S., they're being resettled in places like Illinois. We'll hear from those whose job it is to get them acclimated. That's next on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We'll learn about one Illinois university's plan to reverse the trend of enrollment declines. That and more still ahead. Illinoisans up and down the state may be getting some new neighbors as the state welcomes at least 860 Afghan refugees who left their homes following the Taliban takeover and the departure of the U.S. military. Caroline Kabzanski has more details.
The end of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan set off a scramble among Illinois organizations assisting refugees to gather resources and prepare to greet Afghans coming to the state. Afghans arriving in Illinois will fall under one of three legal classifications. Those who worked for the U.S. in Afghanistan will have special immigrant visas. Others will be humanitarian parolees, who don't yet have visas but have been let into the country based on extraordinary circumstances and will be expected to procure visas within 2 years of arrival. Others will have regular refugee status. Nathan White is the Director of Development at World Relief Chicagoland, which assists refugees in the western suburbs and Chicago. He says this year we'll see a 700% increase in people who need assistance. Just under half the new arrivals will settle in Chicago, while the rest will go to nearby suburbs.
We are anticipating serving 150 or more people from Afghanistan, many of those who are coming under humanitarian parole, and some that are coming as refugees, and some that are coming as special immigrant visa holders who helped our military in Afghanistan.
Families will begin arriving around the second week of October from one of 8 military bases around the country. Some will have existing connections to Illinois through friends and family, but many will not. Lisa Wilson is the executive director of the Refugee Center, a resettlement agency based in Champaign-Urbana. The Refugee Center has committed to assisting between 5 and 10 families arriving in the area, but Wilson says that number is likely to go up as more people come to the U.S. She emphasized the importance of patience when it comes to the new neighbors.
We may likely be receiving families that have no connection to the area, and that is a much more difficult process, because they don't feel comfortable with anyone here yet. So we're asking for their empathy and their patience to help these new families acclimate to life in Central Illinois.
To help new arrivals, White says World Relief is hiring support workers and caseworkers from members of the Illinois Afghan community.
One of the things that we're prioritizing is even if someone doesn't have a connection to a direct connection of a family or a friend within the Afghan community, that we're trying to partner with the local Afghan community to help build that connection initially.
Families arriving in Illinois will need a lot of assistance, and Wilson says she's expecting a strain on the resources of the refugee center.
We're going to be asking our community to participate by offering to volunteer, perhaps for transportation, perhaps to escort people to appointments.
Wilson says housing is a serious concern in the resettlement process, since the abundance of student housing in Champaign-Urbana is unlikely to be suitable for arriving Afghan families. White of World Relief Chicagoland added medical services, education, transport, and translation assistance to the long list of wraparound services newly arrived families may need. He says helping people acclimate and build community in Illinois will take serious involvement from residents already here.
It just requires like a huge community response, and we have some really good expertise in how to do this, but we also can't do it without the broader community support.
The Illinois Department of Human Services is working to figure out if it can take in more arrivals than the initial 860. So this is only the start of a big lift for World Relief, the Refugee Center, and the communities they serve. I'm Caroline Kibzanski.
COVID-19 vaccinations have been the focus of controlling the pandemic, but other vaccinations have fallen by the wayside, especially for children. And as Sebastian Martinez-Valdivia reports, pediatricians are worried about what the lag in vaccinations could mean.
In the decades he's spent as a pediatrician, there are some childhood diseases Dr. Christopher Wilhelm has never had to treat.
I have never in my 20 years of practice seen a kid with rubella.
That disease can cause miscarriages and stillbirth. It used to be fairly common in the United States, but now fewer than 10 people a year contract it, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That's thanks to a vaccine that protects against rubella, measles, and mumps, as well as a decades-long campaign to immunize kids across the country.
People have just been so used to getting shots and getting their vaccines, and that's keeping disease down. Many things that were very traumatic to children.
But now the University of Missouri healthcare pediatrician is worried because those vaccinations are down in Missouri and nationwide.
We would hate for something large, basically having another pandemic with a certain disease on top of the ongoing COVID pandemic.
A recent report from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families found kids have missed some 11 million routine vaccinations over the course of the pandemic. Many people have deferred or fallen behind on routine preventative visits, and for children, that means falling behind on the set schedule of immunizations they're supposed to follow.
Missouri Immunization Coalition reminds you to call your child's doctor to ensure they're up to date on recommended vaccines.
The Missouri Immunization Coalition is trying to get kids caught up on their vaccinations, including for COVID.
You've got the school supplies, now let's immunize.
Kids over the age of 12 can get the Pfizer vaccine. Nicole Cope is the executive director of the coalition. She says the organization is focusing on underserved parts of the state.
One county in Missouri may have a completely different need than another county in Missouri.
The coalition has also put together resources for providers on subjects like talking to parents about vaccinations. Cope worries the resistance to the COVID-19 vaccine could have a ripple effect that outlasts the pandemic. Parents who don't get their kids the COVID vaccine may skip others too.
There's such a polarization around the COVID-19 vaccination that it really, really does have the potential to affect normal childhood vaccinations.
In Missouri, roughly a third of children have been vaccinated for COVID, which is just below the national average. It's on par with neighboring Iowa, but well behind Illinois, which has vaccinated more than half of 12 to 17-year-olds. But the drop in routine inoculations is a national trend.
We really, as pediatricians, have been encouraging parents to contact their pediatrician to see if their child fell behind.
Dr. Lisa Costello is a pediatric hospitalist at West Virginia University. She says pediatricians are playing catch-up to stop outbreaks of preventable but deadly diseases like whooping cough ahead of the school year, and she's worried about how far behind they are.
We need to prioritize getting children back to school alongside their friends and their teachers.
She says right now, doctors need to use every tool they have to make that happen safely. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
Western Illinois University hopes years of declining enrollment are over. Now the goal is to start increasing the number of students on its campuses in Macomb and the Quad Cities. Rich Ecker spoke with the person in charge of doing that.
Western reports 7,455 students are enrolled this fall. That's a dip of just 35 students from last year, or less than 0.5%. That comes after some sharp declines over a 14-year stretch. Dr. Amber Schultz is Western's vice president for enrollment management. She's new to the position and is still studying WIU President Guiyu Huang's goal of increasing enrollment by 3% each year through 2027.
I've only been here a month. I do see a lot of low-hanging fruit, so I'm excited about this coming fall, the spring, the coming fall, and the following fall. And then we'll just continue reevaluating every year to determine if that 2027 goal is, in fact, achievable. But I'm hopeful.
What do you mean by low-hanging fruit? What are you seeing?
I think there's a lot of opportunity to just continue to put our best foot forward as a campus to really market our strongest features and benefits. I think students come here for the high quality academic experience, and we can do a much better job of bragging about that high quality academic experience and getting the kinds of student experiences they have in the classroom and working with faculty in front of our prospective student audience so they have an idea of what they're going to experience, because I do think that that'll put us in front of some of the competition in terms of the academic experience. So looking at how we do our campus visit experience to make sure that we're incorporating the academic experience, look at how we're communicating out to students so that we're doing a better job of just featuring the strengths of our academic programs.
Do you have to do anything different in terms of marketing Macomb versus the Quad Cities, or are you just trying to bring students to Western?
At the moment, I just want to bring students to Western, but I do think it's important to understand our audience and how we communicate with that audience. Currently, the Quad Cities campus caters to a larger population of degree-seeking students or students that are working full-time or, you know, and going part-time and maybe not that totally traditional direct from high school student population. There are some in the Quad Cities, but a larger percentage of the Quad Cities student population are working professionals. And so getting in front of them is a different methodology than getting in front of direct from high school students. And so where the Macomb campus has that larger percentage of straight from high school students.
I would imagine you've read about some of the challenges of the past few years at Western. Mm-hmm. Why'd you decide to come here?
I'm super excited about the challenges. Like I said earlier today, the six campuses I served previously have experienced similar challenges, similar morale issues on the campus because of declining enrollment and declining budgets and cutting of staff and faculty. So I really have a lot of empathy for what people have gone through here at Western, but I also have a strong track record of helping campuses move past that to accomplish some of our enrollment goals. So I think that's why I was super excited to come to Western. I'm hoping to have a big positive impact on the place.
Dr. Amber Schultz is Vice President for Enrollment Management at Western Illinois University. She's worked in higher education enrollment management at a half dozen institutions over the past 23 years. While Western's overall enrollment is steady compared to last year, a deeper dive reveals a mixed bag. The headcount is up in Macomb, but down in the Quad Cities. Total student credit hours decreased 3.5%, and the new freshman headcount is down. But international student enrollment is more than double what it was a year ago. The administration says it aggressively recruited international students this past year after previous federal immigration guidelines, followed by the COVID-19 pandemic, affected international enrollment last year. Rich Egger reporting.
An astronaut and a music legend are among those being given the Order of Lincoln, the state's highest honor for professional achievement and public service. The Lincoln Academy has announced this year's recipients include Chicago's Mavis Staples, who began her career as part of the Staples Singers and is in her eighth decade of performing. Also, the astronaut Scott Altman, a Pekin native who's a member of the Astronaut Hall of Fame. Another honoree, retired Air Force Major General John Borling, and others being recognized are Special Olympian Tommy Shimoda, Dr. Joanne Smith, Northwestern Engineering Professor John Rogers, architect Carol Ross Barney, and investment expert John Andrew McQuown. For most people, vacuum cleaners are just a household tool, but for a select group of enthusiasts, they are a passion. Jonathan All reports on the National Vacuum Cleaners Collectors Club convention. It took place recently in Missouri.
That sound may make you think of housework. After all, a vacuum cleaner's job is to clean. But to Mike Arrigo of St. Louis, it's music.
Each one has a different pitch, and yeah, it does kind of create an image. I actually have one vacuum, which I actually did bring with me. It brings back memories because it sounds exactly like the first wet dry vac we ever had when I was a kid. It's an E flat note.
Arrigo is a vacuum cleaner collector. He's also blind, but he enjoys the sound of these humble appliances so much that he came to Rolla along with more than 50 other people from as far away as New York and California to the Vacuum Cleaner Collectors Club convention. It's held at Mid-Missouri Vacuum, a repair shop and museum in an unassuming strip mall in Rolla. Alex Terzuola came from Denver and said the shop is the Taj Mahal of vacuum collections.
This beautiful display here, it's really worth visiting and seeing everything lined up just perfect and everything you can go through, like it's like a time capsule for different decades.
The owner of the shop is Tom Gasco. He has more than 700 vacuum cleaners, the best of which are on display in his shop. Gasco is one of the top two collectors in the country, and yes, there is debate in the vacuum cleaner collector community on whose is the best. Gasco says he has been obsessed with vacuums since he was a kid, and says they tell the story of art and culture in society since their invention around 1900.
The machines that were made in the 1930s, as an example, are all Art Deco. In the 1940s, especially right after World War II, when we had a national steel strike, steel was very, very hard to get. But a new plastic had been invented called Bakelite. So you begin to see Bakelite vacuum cleaners made after World War II.
All right, so we'll run this one.
One of the highlights of the convention is getting to try out the vacuums, both the ones in Gasco's museum and the ones collectors bring to show off. Stephen Norris of Knoxville, Tennessee, is running a 1968 Kirby right after he took a 1968 Hoover for a test drive.
I think it's easier to steer around furniture than the Hoover to me, but it doesn't go as low underneath that furniture.
Norris says he loves vacuums, but it's hard for him to describe why. He says he's been interested in them since he was a kid.
Get whatever you want for your birthday, and then I would get a vacuum for my birthday, and I guess it goes from there. So there's not a concrete answer, if you know what I mean, on why. I think it's something you're born into is how I always think of it. So,
in addition to trying out vacuums and talking about their shared passion, this community also works to help each other. Charlie Waltress of North Carolina has been working for years to try to get a 1946 Premier upright working again. He thought a repairman he had worked with before could help.
He looked at it and he said, you know, there's not a lot I can do. It's more going to be like a display vacuum. Then I took it to a local place where I live in North Carolina, and it was sort of the same thing. We can't do anything, and it's like I just refused to accept that.
So Waltress brought the vacuum to Rolla, where a collector brought a motor he could have, and Michael Balda of Wisconsin worked on it for hours. Balda, who has had some of his vacuums used as props in movies, says the Premier might be the hardest vacuum to fix.
This style vac is a hard one to take apart. It was engineered to last forever, so you know it's 80 years old, and when we're done with it, it'll still be running it today. So.
That's awesome. I'm glad you got it working.
That's an all-day project.
Was there ever any doubt that you were going to get it working?
Getting it working. No, getting it back together, yeah.
Gasco says that sense of community may be what this convention is really about.
So it is a 50% vacuum-oriented thing, but we really enjoy getting together once a year, and for some people, it's their vacation.
But don't be mistaken, they really love vacuum cleaners. Gasco has a tattoo of the logo of his favorite vacuum, the 1935 Airway, on his arm, and has made it clear that when he dies, He wants to be cremated and have his ashes vacuumed up in one. I'm Jonathan All.
There is more of Statewide ahead. Why some choose to enter the trades for a career. That story is next. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll learn more about the recently approved climate and energy package in Illinois from a supporter. But first, the pandemic has changed the American labor market in many ways, and for some it's prompted soul-searching about the difference between a job and a career and what is good pay for either. That has some considering the trades. Ryan Denham visited a carpenter's training facility in Pekin to meet their newest apprentices.
Christopher Basso spent 8 years as a cook, including at a country club in Springfield. But earlier this year, the 24-year-old from Athens, Illinois, changed course. As he put it, he wanted to do something with his life.
You know, you get tired of that kind of lifestyle, you know, working weird hours. And so I just wanted to start an actual career, not just keep going to work.
Now Basso's about 3 months into what will likely be a 4-year apprenticeship with the Carpenters Union. He's one of many new apprentices who joined the Carpenters in the last couple of years. That trade has seen significant growth. I caught up with him at a Carpenters training facility in Pekin. That day, he and his classmates were learning to build a little rocking horse. Yeah, it's a toy, but with a serious lesson today. Notably, how to use tools and follow instructions.
And they're actually pretty structural. Like, once you get them all together, you can really put some weight on them. Like, one of the bigger kids in my class just stood on it, and it didn't go anywhere. So it's pretty fun.
Basso and others are coming into the apprenticeship program looking for a fresh start. Matt Wachinski is a business rep with a Carpenters Local based in East Peoria, which also serves Bloomington Normal. They've brought in over 100 new apprentices in the last 2 years. He says the recent push for a $15 an hour minimum wage played a role.
Made people do a lot of reflecting. You know, not everybody's cut out for college. I wasn't. That's why I'm here. And unfortunately, a lot of schools did away with their shop programs, you know, back in the 90s to make way for computer labs, and because that was the latest, greatest thing coming up, and we had to get people trained in that. So you can't fault the school districts, but now they're with baby boomers retiring, there's a need to fill these spots, and they are good-paying jobs with good benefits.
Wachinski says the new recruits are coming from all corners of the economy.
Today we had a 19-year-old kid that had zero experience. We had a woman come in with her infant child that was looking for a job with benefits to where she could make it on her own. We had a guy with 15 years welding experience that wanted to branch out, and he was topped off in the factory that he was in. But we could use somebody like that over at Rivian, welding stuff. We can use them on bridges. So they come in kind of all over the board.
The average age of an apprentice was about 26 as of a couple of years ago, a number that the Carpenters want to see lower. Rob Swigel is the training director here in Pekin.
Apprentices have told me because of the benefits, because then that's where they're getting, you know, starting to have families with medical insurance and a pension, annuity, and that type of thing. But they want job security, too.
Swigel took me on a tour of his training complex on a recent Monday afternoon. All over there were these tiny little versions of all the things these apprentices will encounter out on the job. There's a small roof that needs to be shingled, a small room that needs a door frame, their own welding booth. Other things are full-sized, like the steam turbine that they got from a Caterpillar plant. The millwright apprentices learn to dismantle and rebuild that using bridge cranes. Out back, there's a 130-foot wind turbine that powers the complex, plus a dorm where up to 22 apprentices can live, if home is far enough away.
640 hours of instruction over the course of 4 years, 1 week every 3 months. The whole motto of apprenticeship is the more you learn, the more you earn.
And the apprentices aren't the only ones adapting to something new. The training facility itself has added new courses as the industry demanded it. There's now a simulated hospital room where apprentices learn how to work in a dust and contaminant-free way. That makes them more employable for the contractors who ultimately hire them. One of those contractors is Peoria-based Mid-Illinois Companies, where Bobby Taylor is an owner. He's also a former carpenter's apprentice himself. He's on the training facility's board now, helping it stay current with what the industry needs. And right now, it needs people. Taylor says his company, an interior systems contractor, stayed busy even during the heart of the pandemic.
And then coming out of the pandemic, you know, obviously everybody was ready to get out and they were letting loose some of their money. So up to this point, it's been good. The market's been busy. The markets that we work in, which is Springfield, Champaign, Decatur, Peoria's been a little bit slow market, but we see it coming out of it maybe more towards the third, fourth quarter and going into next year. It's been good through the pandemic and also out of the pandemic.
Dennis Jukubowski has seen this demand too. He is a fourth-year apprentice with a local out of Springfield. He has done work all over, including in Bloomington Normal.
It's really good. The same thing in Champaign. I'm currently working on Central High School in Champaign, and we have a hard time getting guys out there because of so many other projects going on in Central Illinois.
Jukubowski started 4 years ago. At that time, he was attending community college, working some construction. He had a young son. Today, he's about to journey out, meaning he'll become a full-fledged journeyman in the Carpenters Union.
It had its hurdles and difficulties, but I stuck it out. It's almost kind of like a four-year degree, but I don't have no tuition. And I got to work while I'm learning, so I was making money.
Now, Jukubowski is exiting the apprenticeship program into an economy that's clamoring to hire him. I'm Ryan Denham.
The training facility in Pekin also provides advanced skills training to those who are already journeymen. One is teaching them how to mount solar panels. Last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed an historic piece of legislation. The Climate and Equitable Jobs Act will transform Illinois' energy sector over the next 30 years, in the hopes of bringing the state to 100% carbon-free energy by the year 2050. The law has a lot of implications for many different Illinois communities, including those that have been disproportionately harmed by fossil fuel emissions. It's also likely to mean an increased burden on Illinois taxpayers. Dana Cronin spoke to Ashley Maybanks with the Nature Conservancy to find out what stands out in the package and how it fits into Illinois' future in this climate change era.
So, you know, one thing that sets this law apart from other clean energy legislation in other states is its focus on environmental justice, and especially environmental justice for communities that have been disproportionately harmed by fossil fuel emissions. Can you tell me a little bit more about that aspect of the law?
Yes, this bill significantly prioritizes environmental justice by addressing pollution in the most negatively impacted areas, and it provides investments for those communities as well. For example, there's numerous programs that provide roughly $80 million per year for workforce development that targets underserved populations, and also includes funding to develop 13 workforce job training hubs across the state, prioritizing those underserved communities.
I know that the Nature Conservancy released a report earlier this year detailing how climate change has already and will continue to impact life here in Illinois. I wonder how you see this clean energy bill factoring in to Illinois' climate future.
I think the passage of this bill marks a huge historic step towards achieving an equitable clean energy future for our state. And the commitments made so far in that bill come at a critical time. As you mentioned earlier this spring, the Nature Conservancy released a climate assessment for Illinois that highlights the impact that we're already seeing in terms of climate change. And it predicts some long-term serious effects on both urban and rural communities across the state of Illinois. Some of the things that were highlighted in the report include the potential for extreme periods of increased heat, increased precipitation, and more increased intense storms. And as predicted, these extreme weather events are likely to continue happening, and it's likely to continue exacerbating some of the health disparities in communities that are already really vulnerable. And so fortunately, this bill prioritizes equity and really positions Illinois as a leader in the nation for fighting against climate change.
Critics of this bill say that the impact on Illinois taxpayers is unknown at this point and could be really high. I wonder what your response to that criticism of this bill might be.
Yeah, it's a good question. There are several reports out there that talk about that potential cost impact to your average residential customer. I think the bill sponsors have suggested that there are estimates that it will cost about $3 to $4 per month for your average residential customer. I think, though, that it's important to remember that inaction on climate change also comes with costs. And so if we don't shift Illinois to a clean energy future, people across the state are going to be faced with the expense of climate impacts, whether it's damage to infrastructure, homes, businesses, crops. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to working on implementation of this bill and hoping that this bill can really serve as a model for other states that are working towards ambitious climate policy.
That was Ashley Maybanks, Associate Government Relations Director with the Nature Conservancy in Illinois, and she spoke with Dana Cronin. For years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and conservationists have been urging farmers to plant other crops in between harvests. They say this prevents erosion and enriches the soil. But as Harvest Public Media's Seth Bodine reports, growing what's known as cover crops may not be worth it in some drier areas.
Jimmy Emmons has all sorts of things growing in his fields in Leedy, Oklahoma.
Peas, beans, there's about three different kinds of grazing sorghum, there's millets in here.
But he doesn't plan to harvest any of this. Instead, these are cover crops, plants grown in between cash crops to cover the ground and preserve it. Emmons digs into his field. He's looking at the dirt, even smelling it.
Smells real earthy and sweet.
More and more farmers like Emmons are practicing this technique. And it also got a shout out in President Joe Biden's first address to Congress as a way to help slow climate change.
Farmers planting cover crops so they can reduce the carbon dioxide in the air and get paid for doing it.
According to the Ag Census, farmers planted 50% more cover crops in 2017 than in 2012. Scientists like Augustine Abor at Kansas State University says that's good for the environment.
Growing a cover crop to cover the soil, to provide residue, to protect the soil, that is great. We've seen that when we take soil measurements, we do soil analysis, we see improvement in soil properties.
But scientists like Abor says it doesn't always make sense economically, especially in dry regions like Oklahoma and Kansas. David Nielsen is a retired U.S. Department of Agriculture researcher. He says it all comes down to a scientific concept called Liebig's Law of the Minimum.
It says the availability of the most limited quantity will be what affects growth or yield.
Nielsen says in the Great Plains, crops like wheat need every drop of water they can get.
So you take water away and the yields are going to go down.
He says cover crops don't always make sense, especially for farmers who don't irrigate their wheat. Jimmy Kinder relies on rain to water his winter wheat fields in Walters, Oklahoma.
I tried it for 5 years, and three of the 5 years it was actually a negative impact on the crop.
Kinder says he is an anti-cover crop, but it just doesn't make sense for him.
It seems to be difficult to get an economic or even a soil health return from planting a summer cover crop in a short period of time.
Kinder says that's why the practice hasn't gotten a foothold with a lot of wheat farmers. Vance Emke owns a seed company in Kansas, but he tells farmers not to use cover crops.
It's just a gigantic fraud. And the thing that is fascinating to me is that it is so widespread, and it has just kept going on and on and on.
Emke says he tries to dissuade farmers because the costs add up quickly. Some seeds can cost $35 an acre.
Then you've got transporting of seed, you've got planting, you've got termination costs. I mean, you're just digging a deeper and deeper and deeper hole faster and faster and faster.
Most scientists agree that cover crops do best in places where there's more consistent rain. But Jimmy Emmons, who travels the country encouraging other farmers to grow cover crops, says the decrease in yields depends on how you manage the crops.
You can have a little yield loss if you don't manage these covers right and you plant too much population. If you notice in here, we don't have a full, what some people would call a full stand. There's a reason for that, is we don't want to use a lot of water.
But even in dry areas, there's one way this practice makes economic sense for farmers: grazing.
If I can take $100, $150 of beef off of that, that's a pretty good return on my investment. Besides the benefits that it's doing for the soil, keeping it covered, not blowing away, not washing away when we get a heavy rain.
Whether it's feeding cattle or payments for reducing carbon, farmers may need to make their crops, even cover crops, pay. Emin says no matter what, the benefits to the soil are worth it. Seth Bodine, Harvest Public Media.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this show or past episodes, you can find them all at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. Also, our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.